Welcome to the 407th meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations. Both to our members and guests who are here today and to our public radio audience reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting of the forum comes to you today from Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. I'm George Look, the president of the forum. The forum was founded in 1983 to promote study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies. The forum is now in its 35th year of monthly meetings featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of foreign affairs and U.S. diplomacy. Details about past and upcoming forum programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. The Midcoast Forum extends a warm welcome today to Trudy Rubin, who will be speaking on Are We Headed for the Next Middle East War? The End of ISIS, The Rise of Iran, and the Murky Future of Syria and Iraq. Trudy Rubin is the foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Her worldview column appears twice weekly in the Inquirer and runs regularly in many other U.S. newspapers. She has special expertise on Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, the Israeli-Palestinian issue, international terrorism, and U.S. foreign policy. She's made 10 trips to Iraq and 2 to Iran, has written columns from Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, Syria, Egypt, Lebanon, Turkey, China, and South Korea. Before joining the Inquirer in December of 1983, Ms. Rubin was Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, a national correspondent for the Monitor, and a staff writer on American politics for The Economist. She worked as a radio correspondent in Prague during the Prague Spring in 1968. In 2001, Ms. Rubin was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Commentary for her columns on the Middle East. In 2008, she was awarded the Georgetown University Edward Wintle Award for International Reporting. She's a graduate of Smith College and of the London School of Economics. Trudy, I'd like to welcome you to the Mid-Coast Forum.
It's really a pleasure to be here, and you notice I'm wearing green. I won't say which team that's in honor of. However, I will say that I'm a Bostonian. I grew up in Boston. I still consider myself a New Englander and a member of Red Sox Nation. So, however, as all of you know, if you are members of Red Sox Nation, every now and then, losers have to win. The underdog can triumph, and that's what keeps us all going. So, well, when one thinks about the Middle East right now, there isn't too much to be triumphant about. I've been covering the region for many, many years. Basically, my whole career have been either based in the Middle East or at least traveling to the region. And I can honestly say that I have never seen a situation that was so fluid, so uneasy, and so potentially explosive as I have seen recently, have been watching, and saw on a trip to Israel, the West Bank, and the Golan Heights in December. I go to the Middle East pretty much at least once a year. Last year in the spring, I was in Mosul, and when West Mosul was still under siege, hadn't been cleaned out yet. And I was also in Iraqi Kurdistan, and the year before I was in Syrian Kurdistan, which, as you now know, if you are gluttons for punishment and really interested in the Middle East, you will know that we have 2,000 troops up in Syrian Kurdistan, also known as Rojava. And so this is an area of interest that I will speak about in a moment. I want to just start first by telling you what I saw on the Golan Heights when I was there in December, because it speaks to the whole situation of whether we're headed for a next Middle East war that will involve not only players in the region, but potentially the United States. I drove along the border with Syria. As you may know, Israel conquered the Golan in the 1967 war when Syria, along with Egypt, was fighting the state of Israel. And when you're in the Golan Heights, you can understand well why Israel wouldn't want that territory to go back to Syria, because when you drive around one side of the Golan, you can practically look into the bedrooms of Israeli houses in the Hula Valley down below. And when you drive on the other side of the Golan, you're looking across into Syria, literally. If you go up a little on a bluff, you're looking right out at Kenetra or beyond. And along that border, you can practically see the whole story of what's going on the Middle East. Even if you can't see it specifically, you can see it in general. When I was driving up towards the northern end of the Golan Heights, I could see smoke rising. You could hear artillery shells. That is because at the top of the Golan Heights, on the other side, you are basically in a tripartite area where you have Lebanon, Syria, and Israel. And on that side, the Syrian government forces, including Shiite militias, were taking back territory that was held by local Sunni militias. When I say Shiite militias, you could have Hezbollah there. You could have other Shiite militias run by Iran. Even the Israelis were not 100% sure who was in the forces that took back the village of Beit Jinn. But we are talking about right on Israel's current border. They have annexed the Golan Heights in 1981. If you go down a little further on that border, you have other local Sunni militias until you come to the bottom of the Golan Heights where Jordan border comes in. And there is a pocket of ISIS down there that Israel has chosen not to attack because, except for one small incident, this local ISIS affiliate has not attacked Israel, and Israel has too much to worry about up near that Lebanese border and across the top of the Golan with Syria to worry about this pocket of ISIS, which sooner or later will be taken care of. So you're looking across the border, and you can see intimations of what could be the next war in the Middle East. Because those Shiite militias, if they are affiliated with Iran, if they include Hezbollah from the Lebanese border, reflect the following, that Iran is the big winner in Syria, that Russia, the other big winner, cannot control Iran, that the United States is totally back-footed in Syria, and I'll get to that in a minute, that Iran has at least 100,000 missiles, which it has shipped to Hezbollah, and they now sit in southern Lebanon across the border from Israel, and that Iran is trying to set up shop big time in Syria, where Israel has been conducting bombing raids to try to destroy nascent Iranian bases before they get established. And so far, the Russians have permitted this. Israel and Russia have reasonable relationship. Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, just had his sixth meeting with Vladimir Putin in Moscow. They have a deconfliction agreement. So far, the Russians let the Israelis come in and bomb Iranian sites, even though Iran is nominally Russia's ally in Syria. However, that has not stopped this missile production and shipment into Lebanon. And Hezbollah in Lebanon is now building precision missile factories inside Lebanon with Iran's help. So you have this fluid, potentially explosive situation on Israel's northern border and along in Syria. Right now, neither Israel nor Hezbollah slash Iran wants a war up there. But the debate is going on inside Israel about whether a preemptive war is necessary. And if that war should take place, it would involve Iran, it would involve Russia, and potentially the United States. So let me back off from this crisis point and talk a little bit about what it says about the general situation in the Middle East today. I spoke to you about the fluidity of the situation in the Middle East. Now, if you look back to the era of the Cold War, we have had proxy wars before, or situations where Russia and the United States both controlled proxy states. We are in a new era of proxy wars that can draw in the big powers that are behind their proxies, but it's very, very different from the era when two superpowers controlled state proxies, whether it was in the Middle East, whether it was in Africa or Asia. During the Cold War, you had two superpowers who basically knew what they wanted. They were sort of trying to jockey for position between them in areas that would not involve nuclear war. The proxy states were generally run by dictators who were controllable and funded by their puppeteers. I mean, that's somewhat of an exaggeration, but the situation was much more definable, much more neat. I mean, today, the proxies are unreliable, even if they're states. For example, the United States used to feel that it had some control over Egypt, proxy state. We had good relations for many, many years. We give them a huge amount of military aid ever since their peace treaty with Israel, approximately $2 billion. We have a very large embassy. Now Egypt is in play. Russia is coming back militarily to Egypt for the first time since Anwar Sadat kicked them out in the 1970s. They are coming in to do basing. There's talks of weapon systems. And so the United States cannot simply snap its fingers and consider Egypt an ally. Saudi Arabia, right now, President Trump has basically bet a good portion of his Middle East policy on a reckless prince in Saudi Arabia. You remember President Trump's first foreign trip in May. He went to Riyadh. He did a sword dance. He and the Saudi leaders stood around this orb, this glowing orb, in a photograph that many of you may recall. And the president was clearly thrilled. Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, has made four trips to commune with the crown prince, MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, who is basically running the show. His father is old and ailing, and this is indeed a reckless prince, but the affinity between the son-in-law and the crown prince has been much written about and spoken about, and MBS was supposedly going to help Jared Kushner make a peace treaty with Israel, although that story was always vastly exaggerated. And so there has been an assumption that since the Saudis are very much against Iran, that the Saudis were our key ally in the region. Well, anyone who believes this should take Middle East Studies 1-1 at any community college, let alone university, because if you look at the history of Saudi ventures in the Middle East and of Mohammed bin Salman's more recent ones, it's one failure after another. And so we are basing our proxy state alliance on a proven putz. I won't go into details about MBS's failures. You can ask questions. I'll just mention Yemen, where the Saudis are mired in a war that they're not winning. This bizarre episode where MBS invited the prime minister of Lebanon, Mr. Hariri, and then kept him prisoner and made him resign. And then Hariri went back home and retook his office. And this was a big failure, an attempt to put pressure on Hezbollah, which Hariri doesn't have the power to do back in Lebanon. And, I could go on and on about Saudi mistakes before Mohammed bin Salman. It is very nice that he's going to allow women to drive, but it is a weak proxy for President Trump to be depending on in the region. But the proxy situation gets much, much worse than that, because what you have now is both the United States and Russia relying on proxies in the region who are non-state actors, whether they are militias like Hezbollah, the United States relying on the Syrian Kurds, the YPG, which is the Kurdish military in Syria, and the Iranian factor, which the United States is hoping that Russia will contain, and Russia is allied with but can't quite control. And then another unreliable ally, Turkey, a member of NATO, which is basically spitting in the United States' eye and is now supporting militias inside Syria, whom the United States, the CIA, once trained and armed, some of them, who are now fighting against the Kurdish forces, whom the Pentagon is now training and supposedly no longer arming, supposedly, but did arm. So you have this mess of proxy forces who don't always listen to or obey their masters, and that has the potential for huge trouble, already chaos, and I'll get back to that in a minute. But there's another factor that is very disturbing right now is that, you know, back in the age of Middle East proxies in the Middle East, and then in the subsequent age when the United States was the sole superpower, you never saw a situation like you are seeing now when it came to Russia in the Middle East. Obviously, there was a period of standoff. I mean, back prior to 72 in the 60s, Russia was big in Egypt. Russia had an alliance with Syria that went on under Hafez al-Assad until the breakup of the Soviet Union. So Russia was a major player, but you didn't have a situation where the United States was becoming more and more invisible, and the Russian leadership was becoming visible in a way that I don't remember in all of my years in the Middle East. When I was on this trip to Israel, I was speaking with Moshe Ya'alon, otherwise known as Boogie Ya'alon, who until recently was defense minister of Israel until he had a falling out with Prime Minister Netanyahu. And at the time that I saw him, there had just been this episode in Syria where President Putin had come to Syria to visit the huge, enlarged, and long-term leased air base that Russia now has in Syria at Khmeim. And if you haven't seen the video, it's really worth watching, because if you're interested in the Middle East, it tells you so much about what's going on now. Just go to YouTube. It's on YouTube, and put Putin, Syria visits airbase, and you'll see it. Putin gets off the plane, and Assad is walking towards the plane. He wants to, you know, be the host, and Russian military officer comes in front. Putin shakes his hand. Assad finally worms his way in. Putin shakes his hand, walks right by him, and he tries to catch up, and he's pushed to the side by a Russian military officer. And Putin continues down the path, the carpeted path, and is addressed by a Russian general. And you have this whole ceremony, and Assad is being held off on the sidelines. And Boogie Ya'alon said to me, when we were talking about this clip, he said, Putin is the new king of the Middle East. And interestingly, I heard the same kind of language from Palestinian leadership in Ramallah. Because suddenly Putin is everywhere, and he is seen as the kingmaker in Syria. He is seen as the reliable ally, even by countries that can't stand what was done in Syria, that can't stand President Assad. Even in Saudi Arabia, what they recognize is that although they hate what Putin did to stand by a leader who slaughtered Sunnis, they respect the fact that he stood by his ally and that the Russians are tough and ruthless. This is not something that I advocate the U.S. do, but believe me, Middle Eastern leaders take notice of the fact that the Russians are willing to mercilessly carpet bomb civilians in order to get their way, and then they win. The Middle East has not forgotten that back in the day in Lebanon in the 80s, when Americans were getting kidnapped in Beirut, when a Russian diplomat was kidnapped, somehow some of his relatives were kidnapped, and I can't remember whether they were murdered or what, but the Russian victim was let go. And the Russians in this regard are ruthless. I mean, I'll just throw in an anecdote. In 1995, I was in Chechnya, and I was standing on a hilltop near a little village called Tolstoy Yurt, and it was a Russian military base. And down below was the capital, Grozny, with 8- and 9-story apartment buildings that were inhabited not even by native Chechens, but by Russian retirees, babushkas. And Russian heavy artillery poured fire hour after hour into those apartment buildings. The Middle East is a place where things like bombing civilians mercilessly and getting away with it gets noted. So Putin as the king of the Middle East. Putin is not without troubles in the region, but the Russians have done an amazing job with very little. You may remember when President Obama's team was saying that the Russians were going to get trapped in a quagmire. Well, the Russians have lost 50 men. This is the latest figures I've been able to get. And four helicopters and four planes. There was a plane shot down recently, and I think that may be the fifth. But think about it. They, along with the Iranians, now own Syria, and they basically did it without ground forces, just with advisors, and with ruthless air power. So you have this situation where the Russians are looked on as the comers, the tough guys, and the victors in Syria, and everybody is going to Moscow, even the Kurds especially, whereas the U.S. in Syria is looked on as an uncertain actor, unclear about its objectives, rather hapless, and this administration plays into that narrative. As you no doubt remember, I mean, U.S. policy in Syria under President Obama basically was, you know, we don't want any part of it, and sort of don't get involved. You know, I understand, I sympathize as a columnist. I went to northern Syria until 2013, then no more, but I went talking to people. Syrians used to come out, heads of militias, army defectors, senior commanders. They would come out to meetings, they would come out to meet with the CIA, they would come out for conferences. So you could talk to lots of people on the Turkish border. And, you know, I came to believe, talking to people I respected here too, that there was an option in 2012. But I think that it basically evaporated by December of 2012 when the United States subcontracted to the Saudis to build up the fighting force, the opposition fighting force against Assad. And the Saudis, of course, armed the worst Islamists, just as they did in Pakistan when we subcontracted to them in the fight against the Soviet Union. So we basically took our hands off. This administration came in with a focus on ISIS, fine. And they invested in the Kurds, and you had a competition between the CIA training Sunni militias and the Pentagon belatedly training the Kurds because it came clear that they were the only fighters who really had their act together, knew what they were fighting for, and were really tough. I can tell you, I went to Syrian Kurdistan in 2016. I went across from Iraqi Kurdistan in a motorboat. You could do it then at a little place called Peshkabur, which is up where Turkey and Iraq and Syria join. And I interviewed the Syrian Kurdish military leadership and the leaders of the women's fighting force. And you may, if you are so devoted that you follow these issues and you're interested in Syrian Kurdistan, which I am very, you may have read that there's very strong women's fighting force, and this is true. They are serious fighters. They fight at the front. They fight alongside men. They fight and die with men. And when you drive through Syrian Kurdish towns in northern Syria, and this was even before the terrible battle that's going on in a place called Afrin, which I'll talk very briefly about, you see martyrs' posters hung along the main roads from poles, sort of like in Philadelphia. They're hanging posters advertising the Eagles or what's at the art museum, and in towns along the north in Syrian Kurdistan, pictures of those killed fighting ISIS. And there are as many women as there are men. And now, I mean, again, just a moment's digression about what is Syrian Kurdistan, because we are very involved up there. We have 2,000 Americans training and advising in Syrian Kurdistan. It is a huge chunk of Syria, if you look at the map. What I want to say about the Kurds, and then I'll get back to the United States, is what you have to understand about this northern part of Syria, the Kurdish part, is the Kurds are very disciplined. They belong to a party, I'll just use the acronym, the PYD, which has a kinship with Turkish Kurds and their PKK movement, which are considered terrorists by the United States. The Kurdish fighting forces, who are in Rojava, which is what the Kurds call their area in Syria, are not formally part of the PKK. They are not fighting against Turkey. But there is no question that they have a relationship. Some of them trained with the Turkish Kurds, and the leader of the Turkish Kurds for a long time lived in Syria under Hafez al-Assad, the father of the present Bashar. And when he lived there, his philosophy was adopted by the Kurds in Syria, many of them who were treated abysmally by the Assad regime. It's a very strange philosophy. It was adapted from the works of Murray Bookchin. Murray Bookchin was a radical who lived in Vermont in the 60s. I kid you not. And the leader of the PKK, Mr. Öcalan, who's now in a Turkish prison, adopted this philosophy of local government. The Syrian Kurds claim they do not want a state. They claim they want to be a federal province within a sovereign state of Syria that has several provinces. This would be a good idea. In Iraq, in their constitution, they have provisions for provinces, and the Kurds have autonomy. So I actually think that this philosophy is very interesting, very plausible. However, the president of Turkey sees the Syrian Kurds as terrorists. He sees them as totally in bed with Turkish Kurds, and the Turks have just invaded Syria in that area of Afrin. I will get back to that. But I want to just talk about the American role in this because it speaks to what I talked about fragmentation, about the Russians being in charge, about the Americans being back-footed and having an incoherent policy. The United States has had a very ambivalent attitude towards the Kurds. Under the presidency of Mr. Obama, I was told at the most senior levels that it was totally a transactional relationship, and that as soon as ISIS was defeated, the Kurds could do whatever they wanted. We were going home. I was told that point blank. Transactional relationship. They defeat ISIS. Yeah, they can lose thousands of their young men and women. Well, this was not the way it was phrased, but in effect, they could sacrifice thousands of young men and women, but they're doing it for themselves as well as us. We owe them nothing. We're leaving. The Trump administration, to its credit, has changed that attitude. And our policy now is to leave 2,000 U.S. soldiers, and there are State Department officials in there. And I don't think this is wrong, but the policy extrapolates from that, that keeping 2,000 people up in that corner of Syria, even though it's a large corner, is going to give us leverage to make Russia do what we want and to make Syria do what we want. And that is utter nonsense. So to give you an idea of how addled our policy is, let me just tell you about three or four things that happened last month. On January 13th, you had a public affairs officer in Kuwait who was a spokesman for the U.S. force make an announcement that apparently the Pentagon had no idea was coming out, nor the State Department. He announced that the United States was training a border force of 30,000 in that part of Syrian Kurdistan, which was going to patrol the border with Turkey. The Turks went ballistic. This drove them wild. The Turkish press was full of headlines saying Turkey was going to invade Syrian Kurdistan. The U.S. immediately tried a retraction. Secretary Tillerson himself announced, there's no such thing. We're not doing this. The Pentagon said they had never heard of this. This is the United States of America. This colonel, I am told by colleagues who were just out in the region with General Votel, this PR colonel was filling in for the regular spokesman in Kuwait. Now, at the time he said we were training a force of 30,000, there were 15,000 Kurds and Sunni militiamen already fighting in this force that we're training. So there's 15,000 already there. We had 230 additional under training. 230. Not only that, but this dumb colonel made it sound like there was going to be an army on the Turkish border. Now, what is the force that we were actually training? What we were really doing was sensible, which is there is a fear that there are loose ISIS running around who have shaved their beards and were not caught in Raqqa, and that they're going to try to cross into Turkey, because Turkey always permitted ISIS to cross in the past. So yes, there were going to be checkpoints manned by this force, much less than 30,000, to try to prevent ISIS from escaping, and also to provide security within that area that includes Raqqa. You have to have security. This colonel billed it, and so not only did the Turks go ballistic, but the Russians did too, and they gave a green light for the Turks to invade that Kurdish area in the corner. They gave a green light, mainly, I think, to poke the Americans in the eye. So now you have a situation where the Turks have invaded in that area called Afrin and lots of refugees, and they say they're going to start going east. The Americans have a position that is just to the west of the Euphrates River, a town called Manbij, which the Kurds took and then they withdrew, but the Americans are still there. The Turks now say they're going to take Manbij. So you could have a situation where two NATO powers are confronting each other and the Russians are sitting back laughing. This gives you an idea of the chaos of US policy, where, yes, it makes sense to have a stabilization force around the area of Raqqa. Yes, it makes sense to get services back on. Yes, it makes sense to try to have a local security force. But you cannot foster illusions that it is something bigger you're doing, that you're going to twist the Russians around your finger, that the Russians are then going to make the Iranians do what you want and pull out of Syria. And that is what Tillerson said was the purpose of the 2000. Tillerson gave a speech on the 17th of January in the middle of this fuss over the 30,000 border force, in which he said just that, that basically the 2,000 were going to be the leverage to get the Russians to kick the Iranians out. He didn't say it in such blatant language, and to hold elections that would be a stepping stone to deposing Assad. This is baloney. So we have a situation in which the United States doesn't know what it's doing, has the Secretary of State who is projecting power in Syria that we don't have, making claims that we cannot fulfill, Russians basically sitting back and laughing, Putin as king of the Middle East. And there's one more factor that I will throw into this, and then I'll let you ask questions. But in the middle of all this chaos, and we get back to how the next war could start, what the administration rightly is tremendously concerned about is Syria, is the role of Iran. It is Iran's foot soldiers, along with Putin's airplanes, that solidified Assad's hold on most of the country, and basically kept Assad in power and are keeping him in power. The Iranians, as I mentioned at the beginning, are trying to build bases inside Syria, and they're trying to help the Hezbollah build precision missile factories in southern Lebanon to produce even more lethal weapons aimed at Israel. The United States wants Russia to push Iran out. This is what President Trump has discussed with Putin on the telephone, and there was a deconfliction agreement that was signed with both of them, and the Americans, including Trump, including Tillerson, present this as Putin having promised to push the Russians out. Again, baloney. So you have Russians are feeling their way, but they know they can't control Iran fully. You have Iran expanding its presence in Syria, expanding its proxy presence in northern Lebanon, and nobody is really in charge. The United States, with its forces, is up in Kurdistan, maybe going to be attacked by Turkey. And meantime, Iran is feeling its way, trying to build facilities, has thousands of Iranian Revolutionary Guardsmen inside Syria, has tens of thousands of Shiite militiamen, some of them are from Afghanistan and Pakistan, some of them Hezbollah inside Syria, controls Hezbollah inside Lebanon, and Israel is sitting there trying to decide whether to preemptively strike at Lebanon and how seriously it can bomb inside Syria. And we are up in that corner there. And we at home can't get our act together such that a public affairs spokesman in Kuwait can say something that gives a spur to the Turks to invade and the Russians to greenlight them in a situation that could lead to two NATO powers fighting each other. So this is why I say that the situation is so fluid and so gelatinous that you feel like a spark could set off a war in Israel's north. And if you read the Israeli press, you see that there is a huge debate going on about whether Israel needs to preempt and take out those missile factories that Iran is helping build in Lebanon. But what you don't see is admiration for a coherent U.S. policy. And just add to all that, then in mid-May, President Trump will decide whether to withdraw from the nuclear accord with Iran. And if the U.S. withdraws, that will set off a whole bunch of additional consequences. But this is why I came back from my trip to Israel and the Golan, feeling that the whole region was in play and there wasn't a stabilizer. Putin is the only potential stabilizer, ironically. But his attitude towards the U.S. is, you know, poke as many fingers in the eye as you can. So he may overplay his hand. And out of all this could come a war in which Israel is fighting Iran. And inevitably, in some way, the United States will get drawn in. So I will stop there on that happy note and take questions.
Well, thank you very much for that very uplifting talk. Let me start with a question of my own. You talked about the problems with our cooperation and alliance with Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Which of the nations or which of the group are our logical allies in this region at this point?
I see no problem in communing with the Saudis. I mean, the Saudis are a logical ally, although, thank goodness, we're no longer so oil dependent. But I think one has to do it realistically and not simply going there with these fatuous, overinflated ideas of what the Saudis can do for us that are fed by a lack of knowledge of even recent history. You know, if you had a James Baker around, if you had a Brent Scowcroft around, you know, frankly, I think that the Crown Prince MBS needs some good advice. He doesn't need a flatterer. He doesn't need a buddy like Jared Kushner, you know, where they can shoot the breeze and make grandiose plans, but he's not getting any pushback. So yes, the Saudis should be an ally. I don't think we have any choice but to work with Egypt, but again, we have to be extremely realistic. There is a reason why the Israelis are bombing in the Sinai with Egyptian permission, and that's because the Egyptians are wholly unable to fight terrorists on their own soil. They seem to be incapable, despite their overinflated military that we support massively. So, yes, Jordan is definitely an ally, but Jordan is a small country and limited. And, you know, obviously, we're allied with Israel, but Israel cannot solve our problems. Israel has its own interests. Israel would like to see the United States take out Iran. So would Saudi Arabia, which is why the Saudis and the Israelis are close. We are not going to take out Iran. Regime change is not feasible or plausible. And the Kurds are our ally, but we are so ambivalent about the Kurds that, frankly, I think the Syrian Kurds will wind up back in the arms of the Russians and the regime. And I think we've made a mess of dealing with the Kurds in Iraq, who are also our natural allies.
Let's start with a really broad question. Why not let Putin remain king of the Middle East? What are the U.S. interests compared with the Russian interests?
A lot of people ask me this, you know, give it to them. You know, if the only problem with the Middle East was oil and we're better off, although allies are more dependent, sure. As I said, this is a strange era when we're fighting proxy wars, but the proxies, they're sort of like Frankensteins. You create them, you can't necessarily control them. Or even if you didn't create them, you can't necessarily control them. Iran could not have done what it's done in Syria without Russian air power. So at one level, Russia is the crucial player in Syria. But on the other level, Iran is really the biggest winner in Syria. And Iran is a problem. And Iran uses Syria to transship weapons to Lebanon, which are pointed at Israel, and also to try to strengthen its position in the region and undermine countries that are our nominal allies, like the Saudis, like the Gulf states. So Russia is not capable and really not interested in controlling Iran's behavior in the region, and we have to work to try to hedge that behavior. And somehow we actually have to try to work with Russia on that and use what leverage we have to try to convince Russia it's in its interest. But Russia is not, Putin is not simply left alone going to do what's necessary to try to curb Iranian behavior in the region.
So what should a coherent U.S. policy in Syria look like? We have a lot of incoherent policies.
Right, and I should add with Russia that in all the time that the U.S. and the Kurds and allied Sunni militias were fighting ISIS, the Russians were never fighting ISIS. The Russians were only fighting Sunni forces that were trying to unseat Assad. You know, we did the heavy lifting with our allies in fighting ISIS, and it's not clear to me that they would fight leftover ISIS or the next iteration. Nor do I think the Russians have any interest in stabilization in Iraq or in Egypt. You know, I wrestle with a question. I mean, as a columnist, I'm supposed to write, you know, what is to be done? And a coherent Syrian policy for the United States is extremely tricky because of everything that's come before. I mean, you can go back to the Iraq War, then you can go to President Obama's decision to just stay out of Syria and to pull all troops out of Iraq. I think ISIS could have been precluded. I honestly do. I think we simply were not watching. So we are limited in our possibilities. There are certain things that I think we must do. I think we must stand by Jordan. I think we must stand by the Kurds. I think we do need to keep personnel inside Iraq, although now that ISIS is gone, the Iranians are going to try to get their allies in Iraq to kick us out. But I think where a mediating presence and staying there also gives us intelligence. I think, unfortunately, we have to have more contact with the Russians on this. And frankly, I see no problem in talking to the Russians. You know, Putin bears us no goodwill. And for some of it, I don't blame him. For a lot of it, I think, you know, it's because Putin is Putin, has huge grudge on his shoulder and wants to poke the U.S. in the eye. But we are precluded from serious discussions with Russia by three factors, I think. One factor is President Trump's refusal to admit that the Russians meddled in our elections and to confront that. Instead, his choice of attacking our intelligence agencies. This makes it politically extremely difficult for him to deal with the Russians and also convinces Putin that he's a patsy. The second factor is that Trump does not understand Russia at all, obviously. He thinks he can only deal with the big man, and if he were left free to deal with Putin, everything would be fine. And the third is that we have allowed our diplomatic establishment to atrophy. And so, in effect, there is only Trump because the rest of it, you know, Lavrov can run rings around Tillerson. Tillerson has no authority. So we are in a position where it is extremely difficult to talk to the Russians about things we need to. And I think we do need to because I think we could create a list of reasons for the Russians, some of which they might buy into, why they should cooperate with us to a point, in Syria in order to avoid another war. But we do not have that kind of diplomatic effort going because our policy towards Russia is totally messed up by, frankly, President Trump.
You were talking about the situation at the State Department, and here's a couple that just follow up on that a little more. Is there anyone left in the U.S. State Department who genuinely knows the facts and history of the Middle East? And what has been the effect of staffing gaps and morale issues of the State Department on their ability to carry out their missions effectively in the Middle East?
You know, Middle East policy has basically been taken over by the White House. The acting assistant secretary for Near East is a retiree, a very excellent person, but a retiree who came back on a one-year contract because there was nobody in a position to take that job. It had been so hollowed out. The last person to hold that job, Stu Jones, was an excellent person who had been ambassador to Iraq, knew the region extremely well, but he was never even suggested for confirmation. He should have had that job, and he was acting, and he should have had that job. He retired, and then they had to bring back somebody from retirement. So when you have the peace process co-opted by a real estate lawyer and the son-in-law of the president, when you have policy towards Russia, which is critical for the region, co-opted by the president, who then makes it impossible for himself to follow through on it, and who makes a fool of himself over Saudi Arabia, augmented by his son-in-law, it's obvious that the State Department simply has no leverage or no, there's a word in Hebrew, no heshek. There's no there. And so the answer is, there's a few good people still there, but they don't have anything to say much that will make a difference.
You've commented on this a little bit, but maybe you could elaborate. I've got a question here on what are or should be the key U.S. policy goals in the Middle East. Oil, preserve Israel, defeat ISIS, others?
Yeah, I think there's some things we can either change or try to prevent in the Middle East right now. I think there's a limit to what we can achieve because the region is in such flux and the leadership is so flawed. And so many countries in the region are going through such periods of crisis and change. So there's no magic wand that you can wave over the Middle East at this time. So I think that our policy has to be to try to prevent really bad things from happening in a position of flux and change. And as I was trying to lay out, I think the risk of those bad things happening comes in large part from Iran, because Iran is inspiring, aiding, and helping proxies who could provoke a war with Israel. And that's the most explosive piece. I think our aim also has to be to keep new terrorist bases from being established. The Sinai is an obvious place. Libya still has no structure, no coherent government. So I think we have to play a stabilization role. I think we have to prevent worse things and war from happening. And I think we have to be sort of very aware and support those leaders in power that are either nominal allies or real allies, like the king of Jordan and the king of Morocco.
And we had several to follow up on the comments you made during your presentation on the Iran deal. Let me read all three of them. They're basically similar. Would you please evaluate the Iran deal on delaying its ability to become a nuclear power? Please comment about the Iran nuclear deal and attempts to undermine it by criticizing it, and what will happen if the U.S. withdraws from the Iran deal?
I think you probably, all of you follow the news, so you probably are fully aware of the weaknesses in the deal. Major weaknesses. One, it does not cover missiles. Under the deal, the Iranians are free to, technically, to proceed in missile development, missiles that could host nuclear warheads. Now, there is another UN resolution that nominally prohibits such development, but the language was weakened as part of the deal, and so there's no penalties for proceeding in the UN resolution that covers missile technology, but that is not part of the JCPOA, the nuclear accord. So missiles are a problem, and the sunset clause. It is true that after 10 years, and it's less now, the Iranians can start spinning many of their centrifuges again. They will still be under an intensive inspection routine, and other parts of the nuclear program, including close inspections of uranium development and many other codicils, will still be in place, some of them for 15 years, some of them for 20, some of them for 25. But this agreement doesn't go on forever. And the last point that critics rightly complain about is inspection of military bases. There is not a specification that there's a right to inspect military bases if the IAEA, the UN Inspection Agency, has evidence that there are bad things going, research or any kind of proceedings that are banned by the accord going on at military bases. It should have the right to inspect. But the Iranians have said, point blank, no inspection of military bases. So obviously that leaves a hole, although it does not make it impossible to detect telltale signs. However, the pluses are that for the next really 10 to 15 years, it will be pretty much impossible for the Iranians to go full bore with a nuclear program. And the Middle East is in such disarray right now that the idea of Iran freed from that accord is rather nerve-wracking, because if they were freed, the Iranians are not stupid. They're not going to immediately rev up everything as if they're holding a sign saying, we're going to make a bomb tomorrow. They're not going to invite an Israeli strike. But they will restart research. They will restart research on advanced centrifuges. They will be able to test them. And you will be entering a new era in which they will be the equivalent of North Korea. They will have a guaranteed nuclear capability. And so then you will be facing the same question we're facing with North Korea, is preemption. And then you're facing a possible war again. Because if you say that Iran must never get a nuclear weapon and you take away that treaty, then you're back to where we were before the treaty, where there were estimates that Iran had, that was only a 2-month breakaway period after which Iran could have a bomb. And you face the question of whether Israel will start a war, which the United States would be involved in. And I think that's the last thing we need at this point.
Well, we're running out of time. Unfortunately, I have a whole lot of really excellent questions here, but I couldn't end without asking some about Israel and the Israeli-Palestinian situation. Is the problem going to be resolved, and does Vice President Pence's recent address to the Knesset do more to improve or lessen the prospects for a peace settlement?
Let me preface this quickly by saying that even if one believes that two-state solution is the only answer, this is not the time for it. Obviously, the Middle East is in disarray. It is very hard to envision the creation of another weak state in the region when all the states around it are in chaos. When the two-state solution seemed most viable, it's when you had strong leaders in the region. It was before ISIS. It was when you had Assad the father, who was a rock in Syria, before the civil war, and so forth. So I think the issue is not whether you would go back to final status talks tomorrow. The issue is whether you leave the path open for a two-state solution in the future when the Middle East may be more stable, and whether you can create some kind of interim situation which is acceptable to the Palestinians and to the regional Arab states. What the administration is doing, what Pence supports, what I think is going to come out of Kushner and Greenblatt, is something that, to my mind, does not leave the way open for two states in the future and is not viable, which is they're going to propose a state with transitional borders, provisional borders, that will comprise 40% of the West Bank, not the Jordan Valley. It will be surrounded by Israeli-controlled territory, either annexed or not, we don't know. It will basically be a Bantustan. It is not viable economically, except totally attached to the Israeli economy, with its workers totally working in the Israeli economy. And Jerusalem would not be included, just a suburb of Jerusalem. I do not think this is a holding pattern that can suffice. Right now, the Palestinian security forces help keep Hamas down in the West Bank and help keep stability. Under a proposal like that, the Palestinian security forces would be looked at as traitors if they cooperated with Israel. And I think that a proposal like that will lead to the end of the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian governing body. And we're not even talking about Gaza here, as if, you know, Gaza's a cesspool. And it will lead to the end of the Palestinian Authority, and the Israelis will have to go in again and reoccupy the whole thing, I believe. And then it's just as far as Gaza. Inside Israel, Gaza is often just kept to the side as if it didn't matter. Gaza is a humanitarian catastrophe right now. It's about 60% unemployed. Trump has just cut UN funds, which basically keep Gaza going right now on life support. I do not think that the proposal that is likely to come out will deal with that problem. You need somehow to have more of an economy revived in Gaza. That's a long discussion. But basically, I do not see what Pence and Trump envision, which they are developing without considering any Palestinian proposal, even proposals that are legitimate. You can argue about the Palestinian case, but they are basically ignoring any Palestinian concerns and taking their formation right out of the Israeli right. And I can say this conclusively because I interviewed Mr. Bennett, the education minister, Mr. Ariel, the agriculture minister, and the proposals that I think Kushner and Greenblatt will come out with, I think are going to be very similar to what they told me, chapter and verse. And in fact, the head of the settlement movement in the West Bank said he thought that they were going to take verbatim what the settlers had suggested. Maybe he's right or wrong, but he's had a lot of conversations with them. So I do not see any solution, and I worry that the status quo is also gelid and maybe will last for a little while longer, but eventually I think it will explode.
Well, thank you very, very much.